Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, September the 9th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning is Jerry Pedersen, and he will be speaking on the nonviolent task ahead. Let's listen in on Jerry Pedersen.
My name is Jerry Pedersen, and this is the fifth session on nonviolence, the way of Jesus, the way of nonviolence. And we'll probably do a few things today. I hope you will share, because I want to look at what lies ahead for people committed to nonviolence. What is the task of nonviolence in the future? But first, I want to just review a couple of things I really had planned to do yesterday. What are the principles lying behind the whole understanding of nonviolence? And I thought a good way to do it would be to look at Martin Luther King's basic principles of nonviolence as he listed them. So I'm going to read each of these six basic ideas and invite you to reflect on them, share any thoughts you have about them. First one is that, first it must be emphasized that nonviolent resistance is not a method for cowards. It does resist. If one uses this method because one is afraid of merely lacks the instruments of violence, that person is not truly nonviolent. I think that this was necessary for me to hear because the whole idea of pacifism suggested to me that nonviolence was really a too passive a thing. It was simply, don't resist evil, as we understand Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount, which is not what it's saying at all, but it was rather, don't use counterviolence in resisting evil. Don't become reactionary, in other words, simply to react in a chain of endless violence, but rather be empowered to act, but not adopting the tactic of violence to violence. Nonviolence is not acquiescence to aggression or passive acceptance of abuse. It is a firm standing up for what is true, witnessing to the dignity of life, and affirmation of human existence, including those who at the moment are acting hostile towards you. So his first principle is the principle of nonviolence is it's not for the cowards. Anybody like to share some thoughts on that one? Any experiences you've had or insights?
No, the obvious example is the execution of the murderer that comes.
Excuse me, I did.
The execution of the murderer is used as an example of doing back just what you're killing the guy for. And it's used against the government, it's used against society. So here you're talking about not being violent against violence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I followed the point. I'm interested.
I have trouble hearing, so if you'd speak up a little louder. I'm not responding because I didn't clarify either.
For those who are in the mainstream America and want to get some news from the radio, you end up listening to talk shows and people's opinion. And there's a large number of talkative, vocal people who say we should not be hanging the murderer. We should not be killing the murderer. And I don't know if that's Christian. That's my problem.
That's funny. I haven't heard
on talk shows, many people saying, yeah, I've been hearing just the opposite.
Yeah.
let's really start killing them. Well, I believe capital punishment is a rejection of all that the Christian gospel stands for. And I think it's counterproductive as well. I think it simply adds to the chain of violence. It's adopting the tactic that you're objecting to. Someone is murdered because somebody commits murder or something equally disastrous, and so we are going to correct that by another act of violence. I think it's counterproductive. I think most civilized nations today have rejected it, and we actually had made progress that way ourselves, and I think we're backsliding. But that's my view.
Go ahead.
As I recall from way back when MLK King was alive and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was really in the front of the civil rights movement, that King always said he wouldn't just take anybody along on a march. They had to go through some training, some discipline. And as I understand it, one of the things that discipline sought to weed out was the folks who were cowards, in some sense, at least, who said, I wouldn't be able to take that. I'd have to hit back. So they trained to turn the other cheek, if you will, when Bull Connor came with his whips or dogs. And if you said, I don't think I can stand that, he said, well, thanks, but no thanks, please go home.
Absolutely. How many of you have been through any kind of training in reaction to violence? I have here, if you're interested, a nonviolent covenant, which when I was at the anti-nuclear demonstrations at the Nevada test site, the desert experience, they call it, this is part of the training. And if you're going to go out to the test site and be arrested, now you can go out as a sort of a silent witness, but if you are going to commit civil disobedience, then they insist you take a training, and then you commit yourself to a covenant. Let me just quickly run through it. We will harbor no anger, but suffer the anger of the opponent. We will refuse to return the assaults of the opponent. And by the way, they use opponent rather than enemy. You never make an enemy. You refuse to treat one as an enemy. They're an opponent at this moment, but you respect them. Three, we'll refrain from insults and swearing. We'll protect opponents from insults or attack. Five, if arrested, we will not resist. We will not go limp even. Now that was a tactic that many had been using, but they say this is a form of entering into the violence. And so you must commit that. Incidentally, when I was there one time, there were some people who insisted they were going to climb over the fence that divided the testing area from where anyone else could be. And the leaders said, no, we don't do that. They were, in a sense, expelled from the march. But they went out the same time we did and went over the fence some quarter mile down. And the whole act, they caught them, of course. But it reflected on what the organizers of this march were trying to do. And that's one of the problems always in any nonviolent action. Six, if arrested, we will behave in an exemplary manner. We will not evade the legal consequences of our actions. Whatever the penalty is, if you commit civil disobedience, you accept those penalties as part of the witness that you're making. Seven, as members of the nonviolent demonstration, we will follow the directions of the designated coordinators. In the event of a serious disagreement, one should remove themselves from the action. In other words, there has to be discipline in what's being done in this kind of action.
Our attitude, number eight, our attitude is conveyed through words, symbols, actions, will be one of openness, friendliness, and respect toward all people in the encounter, including the police and the Nevada test site workers. Number nine, we will not damage property. We will not bring or use any drugs or alcohol. We will not run or use threatening motions. 12, we will carry no weapons. We will not engage in symbolic blood pouring. This was, someone asked yesterday, and that has been used by some demonstrators, Berrigans and some others, but in this, no. Finally, plans for our activities are shared with the authorities. You tell them what you're going to do. You're totally open about it. I had one of the great experiences of my life when I was arrested at a demonstration. I said, well, what I want to do today is just make a witness. I then gave him a 10-minute spiel and I said, the reason I'm here today is that that time was 40 years ago or so, I was out in the Pacific in the Marine Corps when that first atomic bomb was dropped. And it was sort of the beginning movement in my becoming a peace activist and my commitment to nonviolence. And it was just devastating to think that we would use in that manner a weapon against civilians. Actually, we had done worse. We had firebombed Tokyo before that. We had had saturation bombing of German cities and so on. But we were, and we've remained, the only country to drop such a bomb. And of course, we have a lot worse, great, much more powerful things now. I didn't know at the time, but I'm now utterly convinced that the dropping of the bomb was not necessary to end the war, that the process for negotiating peace was already underway, and that there was great debate among the inner circle, which included President Truman, can't even remember the names.
Secretary of Defense.
Who? Namara?
No,
Mac, that was during the Vietnam War.
Secretary of Defense. So
Dulles?
No, Dulles was not yet. He came in under Eisenhower. But, well, there were a number of others. But there are statements, in the records saying that they objected to it. Eisenhower, by the way, who was not part of that circle there, but stated his objections to it. But that both on moral grounds and on its and the non-necessity of it.
You haven't yet said you'd be willing to have died if they hadn't used.
Excuse me.
You haven't yet said you yourself would have been willing to die in the invasion if necessary.
Well, that would have been implied in it. However, there was an invasion planned for November, several months off, on the lowest islands in Japan. But it would have been nearly a year off before invasion of the mainland would have been attempted. And that timetable wasn't, it could have been changed. And so that we realized, in fact, although there are only 70 Marines aboard the battleship USS Missouri that I was on, we anticipated being part of any landing party. And the odds, they were known that initial landing parties, they were 50 and 75% casualties. That was part of it. But
Jerry, are you aware that there's been a whole raft, or at least two or three books now, that just come out this summer on the 50th anniversary, and all of them, and all of the couple that I know about, you know, pick up this, because the data is now available, you know, the documents to look at, and at least from what I've heard and read and seen, you know, that it supports your case that the chances are, were very, I mean, the machine was rolling already for Japan to surrender. And, you know, nobody can guess how long it might have taken. But, and everybody agreed Japan was beat. There were even leaders in Japan said were licked, military and important leaders. I so think that they were in the mix. You know, nobody can tell what would have happened if, but you're saying is a very plausible case, even more plausible now in view of the documentation that's available. Yes. Yeah.
Much of the documentation was only made public, you know, in recent years. So, yes, it's much more strongly believed and felt now. Of course, that doesn't convince a lot of people. And, you know, when the Smithsonian Institute tried to have a little broader exhibit of what was involved in that, the forces of the American Legion, the vets of foreign wars, and good old America first, you know, people objected to that.
One of the most complete stories is in the New Yorker. July. Did you read the New Yorker?
I haven't seen that. I was out of the country.
A long article. And very exhaustive on all these sources. Mm-hmm. Simply a phenomenal thing that should be kept as a special printing.
Yes.
I'll get a copy for you.
No, I have a whole stack of things to back up that statement.
Now, come on, Jerry, but you don't get the New Yorker just to look at the cartoons.
I would just like to make a little statement about that. I think that the dropping of the bombs on the Japanese cities was a serious mistake. I have visited Hiroshima twice. I have known people who were seriously affected by having lived in Japan. At the time I thought, couldn't they have dropped that thing on an island or someplace or another? As recently somebody has said, couldn't they have dropped it, exploded it in the air over the emperor's palace or something to see the force of it or something like that, instead of dropping it on a city. I have spoken with Japanese people who have said that they don't think the war would have ended without taking the kind of action that was taking place. There is a mentality in Japan, unless the emperor had come through the way he did, and I don't know if this hurried him along or not, but there were a crucible of circumstances going on, and I thought that Newsweek took a very balanced view on either side of the subject. And especially Harry Truman, I wouldn't jump on him too hard because of, as you have said, war brings out the worst in us. And there were a set of circumstances there that I think could have argued.
I don't totally disagree with that. Truman's one of my heroes, so I appreciate that too. But remember, there was a few elements in there. One was the emperor had to go, we were saying. Now, we finally accommodated ourselves to that. But that was one of the reasons the Japanese, there are many contend the Japanese would never have surrendered if it means the end of the emperor. And so we eventually gave in on that. We could have earlier. And so there were other items in there that could have changed that mentality of the Japanese. But it's true. There was among much of the military, there was total resistance to it, even if we died to the last man. But
just earlier in August, during all the 50th acknowledgement stuff that was happening in early August, we had a bunch of people at Holden, including the Truman what do you call, what was he called? Not an impersonator, but someone who acted as though he was Truman, studied up on his life, and gave us a speech as if he were Harry Truman speaking. We had forums with veterans from that time, and people who lived during that time. And there was all kinds of different opinions, a lot of tension on both sides of the issue. And we also saw the Oppenheimer film, the documentary about Robert Oppenheimer, helped create the bomb. And I think that one of the biggest lessons I learned is that because we created that bomb, we had to use it. That the bureaucracy was so entrenched in using the thing that, although it seems to me that it was unnecessary, and to a lot of other people, that it was unnecessary, there was no way to stop it. And, you know, Harry Truman would have had to have been a superhuman to have stopped that huge... Yeah,
the whole momentum was, hey, Roosevelt had first been informed of the possibility of atomic bomb by Einstein and a couple of other atomic researchers. And the initial impetus for its development was because Germany was possibly going to have it. And Germany was very close to having it. Then they were out of the picture, and but then this terrible war was going on,
and I
was part of that, so I know. But then, of course, there were some other factors, the political factors, the Russians coming in, and that was a big element in there. We really didn't want the Russians to come in because we knew we had to beat, but they jumped in. What was it, within a week after we had dropped the bomb. And it was as if, you know, they better hurry up and get in there so they'll be part of this victory team. And we had to drop it because already we were formulating the real enemy now is no longer Germany, now it's Russia. And even before the war was over, we were putting ourselves in a position to, you know, to see them as the enemy and build whatever's necessary to rally around that point.
Part of what I learned in all that is just the violence of bureaucracy, and when no one is willing to take responsibility, when you can always say it's not, I'm just taking orders, it's not my responsibility, that is a violence in itself, or can create or perpetuate violence.
We're aware of McNamara's book that he came out with, and one of the interesting things in there, he says, we were getting all these reports from the front in Vietnam, and we just didn't know how foolish our policy was, and that it was, in a sense, it was a dead-end street. And I'm thinking, how could you know that with all the apparatus of the bureaucracy when on my campus about 5,000 students knew it, and everybody knew it? But the blindness of, you know, of those in a position of authority, if, you know, that they've got a policy laid out and it just keeps building. What was it? Nixon, soon after getting elected, he was going to send advisors to Vietnam. This was 1972, was it? Or three?
He elected in
70. After he was... Or was it in 68? He was elected in 68. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's what we got started. Eisenhower sent advisors to Vietnam in 1953. And it's just this unfolding that goes on. And it's almost a demonic thing that people get caught up in it. And of course, the hysteria of violence is the same thing. Well, the second point, Martin Luther King. The second characteristic of nonviolence is that it does not seek to defeat or humiliate the opponent, but to win their friendship and their understanding. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community, while the aftermath of violence is tragic bitterness. And this is key to it, that the whole tactic of nonviolence is to not demonize the enemy, but rather see them as one
for whatever reasons, are doing what they're doing. And so you approach them as friend, so that you don't create, you hope not only to win whatever it is you're trying to achieve, but you try to win them to that aftermath. A little side comment in that. Martin Luther King identifies the principal element of nonviolence, the very driving force of his actions. He says, "At the center of nonviolence stands the principle of love. The nonviolent resistor would contend that in the struggle for human dignity, the oppressed people must not succumb to the temptation of becoming bitter or indulging in hate campaigns. To retaliate in kind would be nothing but to intensify the existence of hate in the universe. Along the way, someone must have sense enough and morality enough to cut off the chain of hate. This can only be done by projecting the ethic of love to the center of our lives." Number three, a third characteristic of this method is that the attack is directed against the forces of evil rather than against persons who happen to be doing the evil. It is evil that the non-resistor seeks to defeat, not the persons victimized by evil. The strength of nonviolence comes from its dual approach, offering respect and concern on the one hand, but at the same time, defiance and stubborn non-cooperation with injustice on the other hand.
I was thinking that people have a right to take this nonviolent kind of approach to things. Something, and I shouldn't generalize, but something I see a little missing in some of the approach people have taken, where they have a conscientious objection to abortions, is they may have thought they were following some of these things, but it became rather militant. It became attacks on things, and I missed in some of the concerns people had with abortion some of the very fine points that were listed in this.
People start bombing clinics, or even shooting doctors. Somehow, when you object to violence and use violent means, it's such a contradiction that you've destroyed the witness you're trying to make. I think one of the things I like is about nonviolence, and it's as you approach people with it, in especially in actions of this sort, your witness not to hate the opponent, but to try to demonstrate a concern for them, a respect for them, a love for them. You're witnessing in the process, if you're doing this consciously as a Christian, is that God too loves them, and that you're not, you're witnessing to a God of love in the process and in the action, if you yourself are treating them in that matter. That's why you're doing this.
I think I should quickly say that there's some people who are opposed to abortion and who have demonstrated, who have spoken out very strongly against some.
Most of them have. And who is it? Who's the bishop in New York? Archbishop?
O'Connor.
Is he the one that came out and disassociated, and he even called for the stopping of demonstrations for a time, for them to get their, their act together. And I'm sure most who feel that way. Yeah. I too am opposed to abortions. But I think the president's policy of
that they should be safe, legal, and rare. Is that what they his point? I think that's a pretty good policy. And I think that a society, I think to start legislating the action of taking this choice away, I think is really government interference with private lives. It's interesting that so many of the people that want to keep government out of things are the ones that want to bring government into the, into the most personal of acts. Want to bring it into the bedroom when they talk about sexuality and homosexuality. Number four. A fourth point that characterizes nonviolent resistance is a willingness to accept suffering without striking back. Suffering, the nonviolent resistor realizes, has tremendous educational and transforming possibilities. Anyone have experience to this? I mean, it seems like it's so central to the Christian faith that it ought to be obvious almost.
My reading, I'm old, I go back to MLK again, Martin Luther King. It seems to me that was the explicit Christian component that he kept trying to put into the whole black movement. And of course, eventually ran into flak with the black power people who said my code word for him, or that he used, was nonviolent direct action. And direct action meant, you didn't just lie down and let the oppressors trample over you. You took direct action, you called boycotts, you put pressure, you put pain, at least economic pain, on people. But the nonviolent thing, even more important than nonviolent, was the non-retributive, which is this accent. I don't know if you have to be, but I would almost guess you have to be somehow connected to Jesus in order to be non-retributive. Even if you don't hit him back, that you don't even hate him in your gut. Because you say, as you said a moment ago, you say, even Bull Connor or whatever the bad guy's names were, that's still one of God's kids, and God loves that kid too, as messed up as he too may be. And to not not give retribution means you must be hooked into some alternative to recompense, like mercy and forgiveness.
Yeah.
And for us, at least, who call ourselves Christians, we say that's because of that guy on the cross and on Easter Sunday.
I work frequently with kids who I'll talk to them about nonviolence. And to even enter into the concept that you wouldn't hit back someone who hits you, I could not even engage a conversation I couldn't find a point to begin where they could even understand that concept. And so I would end up focusing on how do you keep the first hit from happening? How do you keep the first act of violence? Because most of them would say, well, I wouldn't hit first, but I would hit back. And so then to try to begin there. But some of these, the view of nonviolence, and also these are also kids who grew up really, they could tell me more about Martin Luther King than I know, and yet they have not learned in any way the idea of that you're speaking of, that you don't respond to violence with violence.
And you're not saying they haven't learned it, they can't even comprehend it.
They can't even comprehend it.
It just doesn't make any sense not to hit back when you get hit.
Right.
A fifth point concerning nonviolent resistance is that it avoids not only external physical violence, but also internal violence of the spirit. The nonviolent resistor is not only refuses to shoot the opponent, but refuses to hate her or him.
And that's tough.
Even if we had nuclear disarmament in the world, but we still had fully armed hearts, violence would somehow find another way to emerge. We must disarm our hearts if we're going to have a disarmed world. You pose no enemy. You refuse to pose an enemy. And, nonviolence is a tough, tough way. It counters all the natural instincts. And it takes work. It takes discipline. And as I've tried to repeat in most of these, the
story, true or not, about St. Francis of Assisi, who was called a Gubbio, the town in Italy where they were being ravaged by a wild wolf out there. And how do you, since he knew a lot about animals, how do you protect yourself from that wolf, you know? And he said, well, you got to negotiate a contract with that wolf. And the people agreed that they would take food every day out to the edge of the village, place it there, and the wolf would come and eat the food, then he wouldn't come into the city to, you know, ravage people. And one of the groups that I support, Pachi Beni, is a Catholic, small, nonviolent group. But what they seek is to educate and help people recognize that within every one of us, there is the wolf. There's the dark side, the shadow, that is always, you know, it has to be tamed. And we have to go through the conversion, the transforming process of getting the fierce wolf that's in within me transformed into the caring, loving, nonviolent person. And that's an educational process. That's a discipline process. It's a, you know, it doesn't come easily. And you have to work at it.
Okay. What would a nonviolent counteraction towards hostility be? Down at a very individual level, you know, we're not talking demilitarization of countries here. This is a personal situation for me.
Is what?
It's a personal situation for me. Where there is someone who is, for reasons I do not know, hostile towards me. I am not hostile in return, but what can one do except pray, you know, and ask that God's love come to them so that whatever is in their heart, they are showing their shadow side. My question is, what does an individual do?
Appreciation of the gospel ought to, you know, bring that about. Trouble is, the gospel has to be filtered through so much that sometimes we don't get in touch with that. But I thought you could. I believe that in our society, women more often have some of those virtues that go with a nonviolent character. I think men, we're expected to be, we're trained to be, and by nature, I think we tend to be inclined to use physical force, we're inclined to use outside force, much more.
Those are imbalances in gender socialization there. You know, when you raise boys to shoot little G.I. Joe guns kind of thing, which still happens.
Sure.
Not as
still
much.
Happens.
Well, I don't know how innate it is, but it happens. And I'm very hopeful about the future, simply as women more and more come into positions of leadership in the church and in society. I think they have already brought within the life of the church some more gentler and tender ways of handling relationships that, you know, and hopefully men are learning.
Yes. I think women have, but I have also some men, but I mean the constant mother has this problem of problem children and getting into fights and all that. And I think that she fortifies herself by thinking, well, he's had a bad day, or that maybe tomorrow it'll be better, or feed him and give them something. But a mother has to be very resilient about bombardment because she has to live with that turmoil. Bringing up kids is not easy. But didn't Jesus say something about a person who holds hot hatred in the heart? Didn't he? It seems to me like he said, you shouldn't say thou fool, but whoever thinks this in there. Didn't he say something about this? The only way that can be taken care of internally is to discipline oneself to replace it with a wider love or caring or forgiveness so that you leave an opening for a relationship.
I'm going to have a say a little bit more in just a moment that will be a little helpful to that, not in any adequate. You had something and you had something.
Oh, I just wanted to say, too, I appreciate the Christian perspective, but I think we can also all learn a lot from other people of other faiths. Gandhi, being a Hindu person, has a lot to teach us about nonviolence and how to, his whole life was a discipline to eradicate what he thought was the evil, or what he termed the evil in his life. And he, at 77, with all the work he did, he felt he never was able to do it. So it is a discipline that is a life's work, and we can learn a lot from not only other people in the world, but other faiths, people of other faiths.
Yeah, absolutely. You notice I said the way of nonviolence, the way of Jesus. Unfortunately, it isn't necessarily the Christian way, because the Christian way hasn't always been nonviolent by any means. I happen to believe, one of my biggest arguments, there's an institution down south, it's Lutheran, but the director came and I invited him to do some things in our church, and somehow the question came up, was Gandhi Christian? And my wife happened to ask him, and he had said no, he wasn't. And she asked, well, I don't know, somehow he was going to hell because he had rejected Christ and a number of things. And my own view is there's an awful lot of Christians who know very little about following Jesus. And there's quite a few people, I don't know, out there who know a lot about following Jesus, but haven't put the Christian labels together and so on. Gandhi was surely one of those. In fact, he made statements to the fact that he was in Rome, there was the cross, Christ was hanging on it, and how he later said how he wished that he could call himself Christian because of all that that cross meant. But the actions of Christians kept him from doing so. But let's. You have
just 1, 2, 3 quickies. That'll give you terror because you got 6,000 things to do and only 15 minutes to do it. But back to here. When Jesus said, love your enemies, I think that often has been misinterpreted, you know, to feel warm hearted and mushy and gooey toward them, like the word love gets mushed up. The word agape in the New Testament literally has got nothing to do with that. The word agape means concrete act of good, concrete help. Yeah. And that would say, so this bloke is your enemy or he's hostile. You know, even if you have to grit your teeth to do it, do something good for that so-and-so. and over and over again. And two, just before I came out here, I wish I'd remembered the data more. I heard of some formal social psychological experiment that was done in hostility studies, and they divided the two groups. You know, one was the control group who just reacted normally to hostile people. I think it was in a factory. And these other group were saying, every day when that bloke chews you out, do something good to him, or say something good. And that ran for a month or so, and by golly, over here, almost everybody were friends again, and over here, everything was just the way it was before. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is, it happened to me here, I've been here 2 weeks, and I don't know if it was hostility, but I had a very unhappy camper come up to me after class 3 or 4 days ago. And he wasn't mad, but he was sure disturbed at what I had done and said. And I said, buddy, I think the folks need to hear that. If you can come in tomorrow, tell them that. And today he said, Ed, that was sweet. I object to lots of things around here, and no one has ever asked me to come and tell everybody and talk it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just something that's being heard.
That's at least in this case it was. Yeah.
Let's get it out. And
you may not even know what this bloke's hospitality. Hospitality is, maybe you do, but one way to help him, I don't know if it's him, that person cope with it is by giving a contrary response, you know, contrary than hostility.
Differences of view, disagreement doesn't
necessarily.
Number six, a sixth fact about nonviolent resistance is that it is based on the conviction that the universe is on the side of justice. Consequently, the believer is nonviolent, has deep faith in the future. Whether we call it an unconscious process, an impersonal Brahman, or a personal being of matchless power and infinite love, there is a creative force in this universe that works to bring the disconnected aspects of reality into a harmonious whole. Now, you know, there's overwhelming evidence out there to say that that doesn't seem to be the case. But you cannot be nonviolent, I don't believe, if you aren't undergird with this conviction that the universe, the nature of it, God, how it is on the side of justice, and violence is a aberration of the true nature of what is to be. Thomas Merton said, what did he say? No. Oh, yeah. Nonviolence is not for power, but for truth. He might, in another situation, talk about truth power, but nonviolence is not for power, but for truth. It's not for the language of efficacy, but the language of Kairos. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be successful by using nonviolent tactics. It does not say, we shall overcome. We shall overcome. And now, on another occasion, he might use that. But he says, rather, it's to say, this is the day the Lord has made, and whatever may happen to us, he shall overcome. Now, to correct that for language, God shall overcome, whatever. But it's the confidence that you're on the right side, the winning side, the victorious side, the side that is triumphant, even during momentary defeat. And that's the key. I was at San Francisco State University during the critical end of the 60s, and boy, we had a campus strike for a couple of months, and we had 500, 600, 700 police on our campus for a couple of weeks straight, and in the process, I got arrested and put in jail and a few things. But I saw a lot of students and some faculty who were motivated out of including of blacks and more minorities in education and changing the educational process, and of course the Vietnam War, the draft lie behind all the disruptions, all of this. But I noticed that a couple, 2-3 years after a lot of this had taken place, some of the leaders, and some of them were, most of them were the more mature students, older students, sometimes graduate students. How many of them came back to campus wearing a three-piece suit? They'd become part of the establishment, you know? And I'd say, well, what are you doing these days towards, you know, creating a more just world? And, well, you know, get out there in business. You got to kind of play the game. Or and I found that quite often the people with staying power had a faith that they were grounded in, and often could survive the failures that keep coming up. Man, as a peace activist, I've had more failures. You know, it seems like one thing after another just keeps happening, and it would be very easy to say, oh, what the heck, you know. But if you have a conviction that truth,
truth force, that eternal values, the reign of God or the kingdom of God, you're part of that. Gives you a lot of staying power. And you can take a lot of defeats in the process. Listen, I want to do a couple things. What's the task ahead? And I wanted to talk about that. What do you see as the task ahead? But a couple of things for people who want to be part of a nonviolent commitment. And the first thing I'd say is you can't do it alone. I think if you want to survive as a nonviolent activist, you better find some colleagues. You better find some support groups, however and wherever those are. Now, for Lutherans, one of the support groups is the Lutheran Peace Fellowship. And I didn't know we had application blanks, but Margaret found them for me the other day. And here is an application blank if you want to get more information or want to be part of it.
There are a lot of them. Yeah. Right on the registers, you go out from that.
As soon as you walk in the dining hall, right on the left.
Jerry, is it significant that they're colored pink?
I think they had pink paper.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, we're members.
You know,
that's good.
They had a little sense of humor. And the Lord said, here's a preacher from the pulpit, and the Lord said, they shall gradually, so as not to risk unemployment, beat their swords into plowshares. But they, not all people in this are pacifist or active nonviolent, but they have a commitment for peace, but there's a strong element. But they have groups, for instance, a tax resistance group. They won't pay tax. They withhold the portion that goes to militarism. I have not taken that action myself. I, you know, keep debating it. Sometimes I'm tempted to, haven't quite done it. And they do it, but education, they do a lot of things. Here's a little Hiroshima Sunday that they urged churches to have on August the 6th. That'll be on Sunday this year. And it's really tough to get a congregation to use it, but every year in my congregation, we had a peace day and we'd follow this liturgy. And because we did it in the church, we announced it. I got a lot of people that participated who weren't, you know, non-militant or non-violent activists, but you got to start wherever you can start. So there's a lot of ways. And I know the Catholics have what's their peace group?
Pax Christi.
What?
Pax Christi.
Pax Christi. Yeah, great. Or the Episcopal Peace Fellowship, or there's any number of them, and there are the peace churches, the Mennonite, the Quaker, the Moravian churches. You know, wow, they all have all kinds of programs. The Catholic Worker in my area, I share in the Catholic Worker projects because they're not only pacifists, but they're active at work and, you know, with poverty commitments. And boy, it just, if I didn't have them around, I'd be, you know, I wouldn't be able to sustain myself nearly to the degree that I can. In Orange County, I'm part of the Ecumenical Peace Ministry. Or I'm part of the Farm Worker Movement down there, and in Farm Worker Ministry, about half the people in that are nonviolent activists. In your local congregation, if you don't have something, start something. And if you only have two or three people, but it gives, in the name of your congregation, you got a group of people working at it. You'll never get too many people in it. but go after it. I've always said, if you have 5% of your congregation part of a peace commission or a justice commission, and they're really active, you're going to have your congregation do some significant things. And just, you know, but get some association with those people. And then one thing you can do is keep bombarding your pastor from your point of view. Because as a pastor, hey, every time you say something about war or militancy or anything. You got a whole bunch of people bombarding you from over here. You know, hey, Pastor, we don't like that, or even withholding funds, or get some people to bombard you from over here so you can feel the pressure from both sides. You know, if you do nothing else, bombard your pastor. Subscribe to Good Reading. If I didn't have Sojourner magazine and the Other Side magazine, I'd be in trouble.
I take them both too.
You know, they just feed me every month or two. Both of them are terrific. Lutheran Peace Fellowship, they, if you join it, they send you mailings. And
Christian Century does pretty well too.
I'm sure some number. What are some of the other things that are you should subscribe to?
Bread for the World.
Bread for the World, fantastic. Yeah, and that's something you bring to your congregation, have a letter writing day every year. Excellent. Well, get some reading material that you got to have something counter to Time and Newsweek and the daily newspaper and the television. If you do, you just get overwhelmed because the view of the media is not nonviolent, I'll tell you. And it's, well. And then, whatever you do, you have a project. You have, be part of some project where you can express your active nonviolent concerns. Now, that's different things. One of the things for me is the farm worker ministry. I have found it a great outlet because they, as a ministry, are committed to nonviolent approach to things. But there's always specific things to do. Now, and once in a while, you're victorious. I wrote letters to St. Michelle wineries up here in Washington, you know. And about 6 months ago, we took them off the list. They actually negotiated contracts with workers. And these were people that weren't even making minimum wage. But, you know, everybody can have Bread for the World, he said, is a project. Get into it and express in some organized way. All these things will help in what you ask. How do you grow? How do you maintain? But I'm sure there, you were telling about your experience now with the Quaker group, and it's a way of surrounding yourself with a view that doesn't conform to the world. And you better get comfortable with being a nonconformist if you're going to be a nonviolent activist, because it's not the way of our society. Any other suggestions? Well, our time is up, and fortunately, I don't have to review Violence Unveiled, because this is so such a over, it's just a fantastic view. I can't grasp it. It's too big. He traces how, let me just say this, he traces how society, in its primitiveness, violence was a way, and all societies, among the various violences, in order to have some control over it, archaic religion finds one violence, which it then calls the sacred violence, in order to control all the profane violences, the other violences that they're part of. And it helps by having a single act of violence that is sacred. It helps control the others. It keeps it in control. And civilization wouldn't have come about without this. And he looks at Mexico and the Aztecs and so on, and how this worked. But they break down occasionally, and then you have to have a new sacred violence to cope with the violence that I'm just getting into how he deals with the Old Testament creation. he talks about a mimesis, which is imitating the behavior and imitative desire, and he analyzes the creation story. And then he does Cain and Abel, and then Abraham. And Abraham is a great breakthrough in the movement towards a less violent world. Human sacrifice is one of the ways of placating the gods, and the fascination of people is captured by that. And so by offering human sacrifices, now you don't longer have to have all the other violences that would be happening. But then animal sacrifices get placed instead of human sacrifices. And Abraham wrestles with this, and like all the groups around him, he's ready to sacrifice his son, remember? And then suddenly, hey, there's an animal that pops up, and this now is ritualized.